it was a way into thinking about how a constitutional democracy in the United States was going to work in the 21st century in the post-9/11 environment. And it seemed to be, to me at least, to be one of the most important issues of the era. And yet, heading into the 2008 election, as the primaries were unfolding in both the Democratic and Republican parties, no one who was in a position to ask questions of the candidates, that is the largely television personalities who moderate these debates, was going anywhere near these questions. They were asking all the usual questions about, you know, culture war issues and the sort of policy issues of the day, but at no point could anyone be bothered or would it occur to them to say, by the way, if you're elected president, do you think that you can invoke your role as commander-in-chief to secretly bypass apparent legal constraints?
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 12th, 2019. As the 2020 race heats up, candidates spar over healthcare, immigration reform, affordable housing, and criminal justice issues. Unfortunately, substantive discussions about the candidates' views on executive power are seldom on the agenda. Since the 2008 election, Charlie Savage of the New York Times has helped rescue the significance of questions of executive power on the campaign trail. Savage surveys presidential candidates on a range of executive power questions and publishes their responses. This year, he presented candidates with questions about presidential war powers, use of military force against American citizens, presidential obstruction of justice, and more. Jack Goldsmith talked with Savage and Justin Florence of Protect Democracy about the history of the executive power survey, the value of the questionnaire, and the takeaway from this year's responses. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 471, 2020 Candidates and Executive Power.
I'm here with Charlie Savage of the New York Times and Justin Florence of Protect Democracy. We're going to discuss Charlie Savage's most recent executive power survey, his famous executive power survey, the fourth one he's done. And Charlie, why don't you just tell us why you started doing this, when it started, and what you had in mind?
Sure. Thanks for doing this, Jack and Justin. I'm always happy to talk about this survey and try to put more attention on it. The origins of this date back to the Bush administration. I had written a lot of articles and then written a book about the Bush and Cheney effort to expand executive power, to establish their theory that the president as commander-in-chief could lawfully override statutes on matters like surveillance and torture and could keep things secret from Congress and the courts and in all the various ways after 9/11 that the Bush administration set out to strengthen the presidency in a variety of ways. And the constitutional issues raised by their legal theories about why they were able to do things that became very controversial.
Let me just interrupt. One of the things you put on the radar screen that no one was paying attention to was the signing statements and the use of signing statements to disregard federal statutes.
That's right. That was a series of articles I'd written for the Boston Globe that won some fancy prizes. And then, when I set out to write my first book, Takeover, that was just a chapter because it was just sort of the tip of the iceberg of a much larger effort to expand presidential power in many different ways, a publicly visible sign of what was happening in then still secret or merely leaked Office of Legal Counsel memos. Not by yourself, Jack, so much as by your predecessor and successor. And it was a way into thinking about how a constitutional democracy in the United States was going to work in the 21st century in the post-9/11 environment. And it seemed to be, to me at least, to be one of the most important issues of the era. And yet, heading into the 2008 election, as the primaries were unfolding in both the Democratic and Republican parties, no one who was in a position to ask questions of the candidates, that is the largely television personalities who moderate these debates, was going anywhere near these questions. They were asking all the usual questions about, you know, culture war issues and the sort of policy issues of the day, but at no point could anyone be bothered or would it occur to them to say, by the way, if you're elected president, do you think that you can invoke your role as commander-in-chief to secretly bypass apparent legal constraints in national security situations.
And I think it's fair to say that the most interesting and important set of answers you elicited was from the Obama campaign, where he gave some very articulate and fairly firm answers about the use of presidential power that he, I don't know if he later came to regret it, but he later didn't act consistent with those, all of those principles. Is that right?
That's right. So once I launched into asking these questions myself, trying to use the Boston Globe's, where I worked at the Times, window of unusual influence ahead of the New Hampshire primary to get the candidates to feel like they had to answer these questions, even though they were difficult ones that made them uncomfortable, the fact that I got a good response and that those responses included not just Senator McCain, the Republican nominee, but Senator Obama, the eventual president, meant that that part of the survey, Obama's answers, and then Joe Biden's answers as well as vice president, were going to have enduring relevance. Because as President Obama's administration unfolded, on a recurring basis, issues arose in which his prior answers to voters about the limits he believed he would have to respect raised tensions with the problems he was facing and sometimes expedient solutions that his legal team produced to help him resolve those things.
Most notably, I think, as I recall, the circumstances in which he said he would use war powers unilaterally didn't really coincide, especially with the Libya intervention. What were the other big tension points?
That was, I think, the biggest one. That his answer on signing statements also seemed to, he gave different answers at different times on signing statements, as suggesting in some locations that he wouldn't use them at all, in other locations that he would only use mainstream theories of executive power when he used them. But I think the one that really bit him the most was that he had said that a president could not unilaterally order the military into an armed conflict, attack another country without Congress, except in self-defense when the country's under attack. And in the 2011 Libya intervention, which was not a matter of self-defense, he embraced a much broader theory that the president could do that just when national interests were at stake, and got an OLC opinion saying that. But people like Rand Paul went to the floor of the Senate and put up his answers to the survey and said, you said one thing to voters then, and you're doing the thing you said you couldn't do now. And it was a pain. And I think that just to sort of bring that up to the present then, since then, candidates have been more aware that what they say could come back to haunt them, that this is a very tricky thing to get into. And they've required a lot of coaxing, and sometimes it's been successful in 2012, and sometimes it's been not so successful in 2016, to get them to engage with giving answers that might tie their hands later.
Okay, before we get to those questions, I want to get to how you came about asking the questions you asked. I just want to ask Justin, he worked for the Obama administration. I don't know if he worked on these issues, but do you have any sense about the impact at all that, you know, these very clear statements about that President Obama made about executive power? Is this something that it obviously has to be discussed, I suppose, when you're departing as president?
Thanks for having me on. And absolutely. I worked in the White House counsel's office in President Obama's second term. And by then it was 4 years removed from when Charlie had done the survey. So some of the issues had started to shift, but I think it mattered on at least four levels. So one is, you know, as Charlie referenced, members of Congress would invoke some of these answers in negotiations. Two, journalists, the public, advocates would raise these in meetings with us and say, hey, the president, when he was a candidate, said this, now he's saying that. Three, I think it mattered a lot at the staff level. So something like signing statements, even though by the second term, it was clear that he was going to use some signing statements, when people like me in the White House counsel's office reviewed those, we very firmly did it with in mind, okay, what had he said in the survey, and what is sort of the principle behind that? And even if we're not going to be hardline, no signing statements ever, we want to try and shape these in the narrowest way possible. And I think that, you know, permeated through not just the White House, throughout the administration, in my interactions with folks at the Justice Department and OLC, even as new issues arose, the principles that Obama had set forth as a candidate, I think, did guide their approach, and we can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah.
And then the final thing is, I think it mattered to the president himself. Charlie, you and others have reported on the Syria decision, where at the last day, he made the decision to go to Congress and ask for authority to use force there rather than do it alone. And in the context of that, the public reporting has indicated that he sort of referenced himself back to how he answered your questions in 2007 and what he truly believed was right for our constitutional system. And maybe it's interesting that was more towards the end of his term and he was thinking more about kind of his legacy and how he wanted to leave the office and leave these separation of powers issues, but it mattered to him. So in all those ways, I do think it matters.
So this is a very important survey, Charlie, obviously, and especially the answers of the person who becomes president are very important. So how did you think about crafting the questions this year? You had about, I think, 10 or 12 questions that you asked all the Democratic candidates, all the Republican candidates. I'm not sure if you asked the Trump administration, but how did you go about thinking about what to ask?
Right. Yeah, so I did not ask President Trump to answer the questions. He had not answered them even as a candidate in 2016. And I didn't ask President Obama in 2012, I don't think. I can't remember. He certainly didn't answer them. It just seems like the public record and the OLC memos they produce and so forth are their answers to an incumbent president. So each year, this is my fourth iteration of these. You kind of look at what you asked before, and you can see that some questions that seem, it's always like a general fighting the last battle, right? This issue came up 3 years ago, so I should ask about that. And sometimes you fail to anticipate the new issues that will be arisen. You know, no one was asking about the circumstances by which a president could legitimately invoke emergency powers before Trump, and now that's an obvious question to ask. Or presidential obstruction of justice was not on anyone's radar screen in 2016, but clearly is on everyone's radar screen today. So the starting point is, what did I ask last time? What questions seem less interesting and obsolete? Throw those out. What new questions are pressing now and fill those in? I consult with people that I respect on these issues. Consulted with you, Jack, if memory serves, but other, you know, former OLC type scholars. It's like, what would you ask? Gather suggestions. It's possible, you know, from a wide variety of sources. And then I compile the ones I think are best and write an introductory letter to the campaign and draw on my colleagues who cover the campaigns just at a political level to try to get contacts or find those that they don't have, and then send it out and see what happens. And that's the bureaucratic process. And then there's a lot of coaxing and lobbying to try to get them.
I think Justin's organization was involved in coaxing and lobbying. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So Protect Democracy was founded with the mission of preventing U.S. democracy from declining into a more authoritarian form of government. We started the organization soon after President Trump's election with the thought that we might be a 4 or 8 year organization. And then when Trump left office, we'd fold up shop. As we talked to people who are experts on democratic decline around the world, folks like the authors of the How Democracies Die book, they all pointed us to a bigger, more worrisome threat, which is a Trump 2.0 character, somebody who has kind of authoritarian impulses, but a lot more competency and sophistication in using the powers of the office. And so one of our key priorities as an organization has been thinking, how do we rebuild and reconstruct our system of checks and balances to constrain that type of person after Trump? That obviously takes two things. It takes a Congress that's engaged in some sort of checking, and it takes a president who's willing to commit to these things. And so we felt like a key thing that we could do is try and get candidates who will be, one of whom, you know, will maybe be the next president, on record on their views on these. So we did a lot of outreach across the campaigns, Democrats and Republicans, on how this survey was a really important opportunity for them to lay down what their views are on how they would exercise their powers and on what constraints they would support from Congress. So that included, you know, when we first learned that the survey was going to happen, telling the campaigns, hey, this thing's coming, keep an eye out for it. We pestered them, who's responded, this is the deadline, are you doing it? Hey, we hear this other campaign's doing it, we've been talking to them, if you don't do it, you'll be left out. We talked them talked through the answers at length with them. We drafted our own model answers, so we had a sense of what we thought was right, and we advised the campaigns on what we thought good answers were in a way to help them do it. So, you know, obviously, Charlie and his colleagues at the Times get the lion's share of the credit for getting these answers in, but we were really thrilled to see that, you know, effectively every major candidate both Democrats and Trump's Republican challengers all answered these and did so in pretty detailed, thorough ways, you know, not just kind of a one-sentence throwaways.
Okay, Charlie, let's move on to what the answers were. What were the kind of big takeaways from the answers of the candidates about executive power? Do you want to walk through and tell us what the questions were, or do you just want to tell us what you thought the big takeaways were?
Because the response this cycle was so pervasive, like we got almost all of the major candidates, it's kind of hard to say, well, the takeaway was this, because the question is, are you zooming in to see what did, you know, Joe Biden say, or do you give equal weight to?
Let's start with Biden then, because I thought that his answers were the most distinctive in a couple of ways, and then you can, either one or both of you can comment on this. One, he seemed to me, as a former executive branch official, as having the most realistic conception of executive power, in the sense that he was probably the most moderate overall in what he suggested about executive restraint, although he did propose lots of restraints. And also, I think it was notable, I think you noted this in your cover story, that his views appeared to have changed from when he was a candidate for president coming out of the Senate and after he had served as vice president for 8 years. So can you just basically tell us about Biden?
Yeah, so Biden was particularly interesting, not only because he is, or at least has been, the front runner, but because he had answered the questions in 2008. And so you could see how sitting in the White House for 8 years changed his perspective from what it had been when he had been sitting in the Senate for 30 years. I agree with you that there are places where, you said most moderate, I would say most executive power friendly. Relative to others, others were taking more purist positions. I will never do this, I will never do that. And he was like, well, maybe I will sometimes do this or sometimes do that. The place where he changed from his being a senator to being an 8-year vice president was on war powers. He was, like Senator Obama in 2008, ruled out the lawfulness of a president ordering the military unilaterally to attack another country absent a self-defense rationale. Without congressional authorization, but in 2008. And this year, he had a wider conception of when that would be lawful, that so long as it's a limited strike or limited set of attacks, which is what Obama called Libya, because it was an air war, not ground forces, and so long as the president decides that American interests would be served by it, he thinks a president can unilaterally do that, with the important caveat that the question where this comes up the most often, which is, what about bombing Iran over nuclear sites? He says that would still require Congress because of the risk of an escalation into a major conflict.
Which basically, it sounded like to me in that part of his answer, he was just following the OLC opinion, the Libya OLC
That's right.
opinion.
He was he was not going to put space between himself and the Obama record. Another place where he diverged from some colleagues was on the question of commander-in-chief override power, the claimed authority of a president when acting as commander-in-chief to bypass a statutory constraint in a national security situation. I asked about three scenarios, two Bush and one Obama, the Bush scenarios being surveillance law and torture law, and the Obama surveillance example being Obama's disregard of a law requiring the executive branch to give Congress 30 days advance notice before transferring someone out of Guantanamo, which Obama violated in the Bowie-Bergdahl prisoner swap. And several candidates like Kamala Harris and others were like, all three of those actions were unlawful. The president, all three of those statutes are binding on the president. The president has to obey them. So criticizing Obama, not just Bush. Biden was not willing to do that. He criticized Bush on the torture and surveillance issues, but said that it was a lawful exercise of commander-in-chief authority for Obama to disregard that prisoner exchange statute in a POW exchange situation.
Let me just ask you, so Biden's switch makes me a little cynical about the usefulness of these questions, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, but I wonder whether his views represent genuine changes in outlook, or if he just wasn't in a position to walk back the positions of the Obama administration, which he participated in. And you know, he, because especially on War Powers, this change was pretty stark. Do you have any sense of, I mean, your survey can't answer that, but I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Well, I think that, so this is speculation. I have not talked to Senator Biden about this. And I wonder if Justin, with his, you know, Democratic lawyer back channel conversations, might have some insight to add. But I think that, for one thing, Vice President Biden watched President Obama struggle with these legal policy issues against the backdrop of having tied his own hands, rhetorically at least, in the 2008 survey, and anticipating that he might very well win the presidency, wanted to avoid the problems that Obama ran into. And so, you know, yes, it's not a binding contract, and a politician can always act differently than he or she said she would when running for office. But it does create headaches. It does create turbulence. It does create criticism. It creates an issue when you say one thing and then do another. And so when Biden allows himself the wiggle room to use force in certain situations without Congress to that he wasn't going to allow himself as a senator, I think it's just anticipating that he doesn't want Rand Paul on the floor of the Senate holding up that answer and making him look like a hypocrite. And in the same way, we haven't talked about the post-Trump reform section of this yet, but he was clearly more cautious on places where it was anticipatable that it might really matter to him. He was all for, yeah, the president should be legally required to disclose his tax returns or forbidden from hiring a family member of the White House in a nepotism way, but he wasn't going to restrict a president's ability to use the Vacancies Reform Act to install someone in office temporarily without Senate confirmation in a place where the politics get jammed up and where other people were willing to roll back that authority, seeing how Trump has used it. And he seemed very reluctant to mess with emergency power, exigent circumstance authorities, notwithstanding Trump's record, because he could see himself in a situation in which he needed that. And he was, I think, therefore, more executive power friendly than people who had only worked in the executive branch.
Okay, we'll get to those reforms in a moment. Justin, do you have any thoughts about what motivated Biden's change?
I think Charlie's points are right. One thing I would add is, as we've seen from the campaign, Biden has really been hugging Obama and Obama's record as kind of a core rationale for his candidacy within the Democratic primary. And so I think anything he does that puts distance between him and actions the Obama administration took is going to be dicey political ground for him in the primary. And so I think that may have pushed them towards adhering to Obama policies on these things. I'd also just say, you know, taking in mind Charlie's point that he's going to have to live with everything he said, he did answer this. He could have not answered it. And on a lot of stuff, he did sort of lay out a willingness to accept constraints, yeah, whether and how he'd act or the future. So I think there's another way to view this, which is, sure, he, you know, didn't go kind of a full dial back executive power path, but knowing that this matters, knowing it'll be quoted back to him, knowing his staff, if he's in the Oval Office, are going to be following this, he still said a lot and a lot about constraints that he would follow.
He did. But to me, reading his answers, he was clearly the most sensitive to the reality of executive power and what he was going to be able to accept and whatnot. That's just the way I read it. And by contrast, for example, Charlie, tell me if this characterization is right. I thought that Senator Sanders' answers were the most, of the leading candidates, were the most kind of unambiguously firm in kind of restraining executive power. For example, I think he said he would never use signing statements or something like that. Is that fair to say that he was, if Biden was kind of nuanced and sensitive to executive power, is it fair to say that Sanders was on the kind of very starkly in favor of constraining executive power?
If you screen out we're just talking about the people at the very top, you know, the double-digit
people.
I do think that's right. Yes, he clearly said he would just never use signing statements, and other people left themselves wiggle room or said, sure, took the position that it's easier to, you know, as long as the theories of executive power are mainstream ones, that's fine. He said that even the Bowie-Bergdahl prisoner exchange use of commander-in-chief authority was illegal. He wasn't the only one, the top tier, who said that. But I struggle to think off the top of my head of a place where he was more executive power friendly than one of the other top tier candidates. He was more purist.
Yeah. So I want to get on to the reforms, but I'm just wondering, are there any other surprises about, again, let's just limit ourselves to the top candidates, the people that are kind of in the top tier. Were there any other answers to the questions that surprised either one of you?
So to me, if you kind of jump back from the trees to the forest, what stood out was the consensus across the candidates, and not just the Democratic contenders, but the non-Trump Republican candidates. And, you know, from Warren on the left of Buttigieg and the kind of centrist Democrat to Jill Walsh on the Tea Party right, you could actually, I think, take the candidates' names off the questionnaire and you might have a hard time knowing which was which. And that is, in the political environment we live in, pretty shocking and not something I think you'd see on any other issues that, you know, if you did a survey on healthcare or immigration or tax policy.
But wait a second, why is it shocking? I mean, these are all candidates that are one way or another running against Trump, and Trump has been extreme on these issues. I don't find it shocking.
I think you could, so that is fair, but I think it exposes that Trump is a outlier from across people with a lot of different ideological views. No. Generally on these issues, Trump is in one place and everybody else is in a different place. And it may be that Biden is a little more on one side or right. Sanders is a little more on one side. But, you know, some of the stuff that, like from the perspective of Protect Democracy, Joe Walsh's answers might have been the ones that are most close to how we feel about this issue. And I work in the Obama administration.
Charlie, any other surprises or things worth noting in general before we get to the reforms?
Well, I actually think the reforms part is the most interesting.
Let's move to that then. So I think this was your last question, is that right?
It was, but it was like a dozen questions embedded in one question.
Yeah, so you asked, I'm going to read the context. You said in the question, many recent disputes have raised this prospect that Congress in a post-Trump era will seek to tighten legal limits on executive power to enforce previous norms of presidential behavior. And then you asked, what sorts of new legal restrictions on presidential authority, if any, would you view as constitutional and be inclined to sign into law on these topics? And then you listed about, looked like about a dozen potential reforms. Is that right?
That's right.
And so, and I remember in your story, I think in the first paragraph of your story that accompanied this, you said something like, it looks like if a Democrat president is elected, there's going to be major constitutional reform akin to what happened in the Watergate era or something like that.
Or an echo of it. Because there were so many questions in which there was a broad consensus that it would be constitutional and appropriate for Congress to enact legislation in this area or that area or this other area, framing and constraining the use of presidential power in ways that previously were restrained only by norms, and that Trump violated those norms. And so there was not unanimity, but it did look like, you know, you could envision a scenario, and maybe this is what we're going to get in reality as opposed to what they're trying to tell voters at this point, but you could envision a scenario in which the next president takes office having defeated Trump hypothetically in the next election and says, as Obama did in 2009, we need to look forward, not back. I have my own policy agenda. I have only so many political chits to play, and I'm not interested in tying my own hands or, you know, wasting a lot of time on the floor of Congress with stuff that I'm not going to do anyway. Look, here's my tax reforms, tax returns. We don't need a law saying I have to give them out. I'll just do it. And let's instead use that time to enact, you know, whatever, next phase of healthcare reform or something. But there seems to be here at least a lot of people going on the record saying, no, I would sign that if Congress passed it. I would sign this. I would sign that. Maybe I wouldn't sign this other thing.
So let me make a prediction about what will happen, and then y'all can. So you're right. That's a fair characterization of the answers you got. There was really remarkable support for pretty broad reform. Let me suggest that what will happen if a Democrat wins, and especially if the Democrats control Congress, I think it will be very easy to get, and I think this kind of tracks Biden's answers, by the way, very easy to get reform on things like conflict of interest, emoluments, tax returns, the kind of things that were done by norms that presidential candidates and presidents abided by that Trump has violated. and that really no one has an interest in defending. And I think those are kind of low-hanging fruit reforms. But I think as we get closer to, and then, you know, moving through the spectrum to things that get to the core of operating the executive branch and closer to kind of presidential prerogative related to Article II as opposed to kind of private matters, whether it's, you know, FOIA inside the White House or presidential war powers, some of those issues, I predict, you know, maybe even emergency powers, that there might be a movement to reform emergency powers, but I predict that whoever's the president will kind of want to maintain as much discretion as there. I predict it's going to kind of break out that way, and I wonder what you guys think.
You want to start, Justin?
Sure. I think there's, you know, a lot of negotiation and politics to happen around this. Certainly some of these are easier than others, but I think I'm not as pessimistic for a couple of reasons. One is we've got the candidates on the record now on some of these issues. Two is there's actually some pretty broad bipartisan movement in Congress, sort of under the radar in some ways on some of these issues. So take emergency powers. Mike Lee has introduced a bill called the Article I Act that moves to more of a sunset and renew model where you don't have kind of endless presidential emergencies, but Congress has expedited procedures to approve them. That just earlier this year went through the Senate Homeland Security Committee with an 11-2 bipartisan vote. There's Democratic support for it. And, you know, you could see a broad constituency in Congress, including, you know, Mitch McConnell's Senate Republicans behind this, and in negotiations with the White House over, you know, say it's President Warren bringing her anti-corruption bill, which she said will be her first bill to Congress, you could see a real congressional interest in getting some of these other measures that take back some authority for Congress included, like emergency powers, like war powers, like congressional oversight. The other thing I'd say is that I think balanced out against each president's interest in preserving some flexibility within which to act, there are some advantages to them of ceding a little bit of power to Congress and restoring checks and balances. One, there's just kind of the deep constitutional value of shoring up our democracy and leaving the office and the separation of powers in a stronger position than they found it. Two, dialing back some of the excesses of executive authority can actually make some of their changes more robust and sustainable. So a lot of the things that President Obama did with executive power, Trump has undone. That's not a great legacy to leave behind. And three, there's just can be a political comfort in having another branch responsible for something, you know, on war powers, on the Syria thing. I think it takes a lot of weight off the shoulders of a new president if it's not all on her, all on him to make every one of these decisions and enlisting Congress as a partner and giving Congress some responsibility that they have to carry their load as an institution can be valuable to a president. So for all those reasons, I think there is a real, real opportunity here to do some of the big stuff. And needless to say, there is a big need to do it. So we and others will be pushing hard to make it happen.
Charlie, what do you think?
Well, I agree with you, Jack, that the closer this gets to or normal president Article II stuff, the harder it's going to be. It's no skin off of most potential presidents' noses to say, I'm going to not hire my family into the White House or keep my tax return secret, because they wouldn't have done that anyway. I do think that there are some places in of these answers where things do start to cut on Article II, where nevertheless there seem to be pretty broad consensus, even by the sort of moderate, in your phrasing, Biden, that legislation could happen. For example, codifying limits on removing a special prosecutor. He was open to that. Elizabeth Warren was open to that, et cetera. Obviously, Trump didn't end up firing Mueller, but there was so much saber rattling about that 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 became an issue. And it does seem like maybe this is going to be a pendulum swing back moment from the creation of the independent counsel law after Watergate, the collapse of it after Whitewater, and maybe there is room there for something a president, the next president, would sign. Clearly, Biden is not interested in restricting his ability to invoke emergency powers if he becomes president, but some of his rivals, including Elizabeth Warren, did seem to be open to that. And Biden also said, for example, that he was open to the notion that he might by statute be required to give Congress information about people that he's thinking about pardoning, which is would cut at the core of Article II authority. So that it's not a clean, you know, just idiosyncratic Trump stuff can get through that wouldn't matter anyway in a normal presidential administration. It does look like there's room here, at least on what they've said, for some stuff that would cut into even the world of Article II.
Okay, great. In closing, I want to ask you guys about two particular concrete reforms or proposals that were in your question, Charlie, and predict what a Democrat president would do. One is the OLC opinion on the indictability of the president. That was one of the things you asked about, and there were some interesting answers on that. I wonder what you think is going to happen on that. And the second is the Assange prosecution. I'm just wondering on those two things in particular, in closing, what y'all predict will happen.
So I may answer this a little tangentially on both fronts. One of the things that I think is so important about the questionnaire is the line of questions that goes to independence between the White House and the Justice Department. And this is a place where obviously we have seen Trump in so many ways and those around him in the White House so involved in a lot of DOJ decisions in a way that is really problematic and that busts through the norms of how previous White Houses from both parties have operated. And there is remarkable consensus in the answers to the questions that we've got to rebuild some of the distance between the White House and DOJ. And I think that goes to both of the questions that Jack asked, that we will move to a world where the next president is not making those types of decisions.
Well, which way does that cut for the OLC opinion? One of the, I think it was Klobuchar who said she would direct OLC to reverse the opinion.
I think we will see them appoint an attorney general who has more constrained views of executive power than we have seen recently. And I think they will leave it to that attorney general and the assistant attorney general in charge of OLC to make those decisions. And, you know, this will be a point that we keep hammering them on. Some of the candidates, like one of the candidates in particular early on said, you know, she will direct her Justice Department to prosecute President Trump for obstruction when she's in office. And right. We said, no, you cannot do that. That is exactly the type of things Trump has seen. And to her credit, she walked that back very firmly in television interviews and the answers here. And I do think that people who are in these roles who are probably going to be, you know, former prosecutors or former judges or law professors will take a fresh look at them. But I don't think you'll have, you know, the White House counsel calling up and saying, do this or that on this opinion.
Charlie, what do you think?
I guess I just observed both of the questions. You invoked the OLC memo on presidential indictability and the Espionage Act charges against Assange for journalistic style activities. Resulted in a lot of mealy mouth statements, a lot of punting answers where they weren't really taking a clear position on what they thought. Therefore, it's a little hard to derive too much out of that. But there were a couple takeaways. There was an element of the presidential indictability question was, would you at least sign legislation that told the statute of limitations for offenses by a president who, while he or she's in office, you don't have a president getting away with a crime because 5 years have passed and they just couldn't be charged. If for no other reason that DOJ has this opinion. And there was broad consensus that they would sign. The ones who thought it was the OLC reasoning that a president can't be indicted was a mistake, and the ones that thought it was correct, and the ones who didn't take a clear position, pretty much everyone said, yes, regardless of that, I would sign legislation to toll the statute of limitations for a sitting president. So that's another place where there could be a meaningful reform in a post-Trump era. On press freedoms, it was so... the answers were so mealy-mouthed. Basically, everyone had a lot of hand-wringing statements about press freedoms, but only, I think, Tulsi Gabbard and Marianne Williamson said that they would drop the case against Assange. I think only Hickenlooper said he would not drop the case against Assange, and everyone else kind of either didn't answer the question at all or said it was inappropriate for a president to tell DOJ what to do with a case, even a case that they inherited. So I don't know what to do with that as much. But I think the tolling of the statute of limitations was a concrete takeaway from that. Otherwise, ambiguous set of answers.
Okay, that's all the questions I have. Do you guys have any closing thoughts?
I mean, I think I'd just pause on, I think, Charlie, this is the first time that your survey has asked this set of questions about not just how the president will act in office, but accepting legislative checks. And I think that is a pretty significant thing to have included. And that there will be a tendency when Trump leaves office, whatever that is, to sort of say, okay, you know, whether it's through impeachment or resignation or election, we've kind of cured the sickness, we can move on. But, you know, the antibiotics here aren't enough, and we do need a vaccine against the future version of this, and that's what this new set of laws is. So I think that the survey has done a really remarkable service in spurring the debate along and getting these folks on the record on what they'll support and what they'll accept.
Charlie, any reflections on what you've accomplished here?
Well, I don't want to say what I accomplished. I just put the survey together. People like you, Jack, helped me, you know, when I think about the questions. People like you, Justin, helped me lobby these very busy campaigns dealing with lots of different competing demands to get them to engage. And in general, though I'm happy, we've talked a lot about norms here, that maybe a norm is developing that these are questions that someone who wants to be president will have to engage with before voters decide whom to entrust with these authorities. I think that that should be a hurdle that anyone who wants to be president needs to get over. I was disappointed in 2016 when neither Donald Trump nor Hillary Clinton would answer these questions. I think that was a mistake. And the very robust answers this year give me some confidence that these are the sorts of things that are among the pieces of information that voters will be expecting to have in presidential cycles to come.
Great. Thank you both very much. That was fun.
Thanks a lot.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Charlie Savage and Justin Florence for coming on the show. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, socks, and more. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howe, and your audio engineer this week is Jacob Schultz. Our music is performed, as always, by Sophia Yan. And thank you for listening.